Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 festival.
Badru Wiradjuri Gibi Adira Madalinya Badu Wiradjuri Nadu Yindimara Mayindi Ninagara Niani Buagalingura Nina Yiradu. That's the words of my people, the Wiradjuri people, welcoming you here tonight, thanking you all for coming, and paying respects to the first people of this land, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. So we're here to talk about... We're here to talk about words and music and literature, and Paul and I have been doing this for the last couple of hours backstage, so we've got a lot to talk about, and we're probably only halfway through.
We almost came out with a Hank Williams show all the way through. But
that's right. We've been singing Hank Williams songs out the back, and we'd have been happy just playing and singing Hank Williams songs tonight. But Paul's going to start with a song of a poem that he's chosen, and then we'll have a conversation about why this song matters and why words and music matter to Paul.
I thought it's a good opening up poem, song, "And Death Shall Have No Dominion," written by Dylan Thomas. The title comes from one of Paul's letters to the Romans.
"Death shall have no dominion. Dead men naked shall be one with the man in the wind and the west moon. When their bones are picked clean and the clean bones gone, they'll have started elbow and foot. Though they be mad, they shall be sane. Though they sink through the sea, they shall rise again. The lovers be lost, love shall not. Death shall have no dominion. Death shall have no dominion. Under the windings of the sea, they lie in long, shall not die windily. Twisting on racks till sinews give way, strapped to a wheel, yet they shall not break. Faith in their hands shall snap in two, and the unicorn evils run them through. Split all ends up, they won't crack. Death shall have no dominion. Death shall have no dominion. Death shall have no dominion. No more shall gulls cry at their ears, or waves break loud on the seashore. Where blue a flower may a flower no more lift its head to the blows of the rain. Though they be mad and dead as nails, heads of the characters hammer through daisies, breaking the sun till the sun breaks down. Death shall have no dominion. Death shall have no dominion, and death shall have no dominion."
My great-grandfather was known as a storyteller among Wiradjuri people. He carried with him the stump of an old carved tree, an old ceremonial tree that my great-great-grandmother Guruwin had given to him as they were being cleared from the land. And he'd move around from mission to mission, and he'd set up the little stump next to the fire, and he'd tell stories. So I want you to imagine that the little stump's here tonight, and the fire's going, and we're going to talk about stories with one of Australia's great storytellers. "Death shall have no dominion." Why did you choose that? What is it in that that spoke to you?
I actually chose it because it's a poem I don't really understand. But it's a poem I just keep coming back to. It's a stream and a flood of images that hang together for me sound-wise and poetically. But it's a poem that you couldn't sort of wrap it up and put it in a packet of meaning. It's to me, it's an expansive poem, and it opens out. And that's what I think that great poetry does. It can't be reduced. it can't be paraphrased, which you know, people often get worried that they're saying, I don't understand this poem, I'm feeling dumb, I don't understand this poem. I said, you don't have to understand the poem, just experience the poem. So this poem that I've loved for a long time, I experience it every time I sing it without, but I couldn't say to you.
Yeah.
I mean, and Desha Have No Dominion, that says the same thing as Rumi, who we were talking about before. The grief armies assemble, but I'm not going with them. So Death Shall Have No Dominion, that's pretty clear. But the rest of the poem's just, is itself. I can't explain it. Mm.
And you know, I think about what opened me up to stories and to poetry and to music. And it was someone else who was a poet that I was exposed to when I was a boy, and someone we were singing backstage, Hank Williams. And I remember hearing when I was 5 or 6 years old, this beautiful Hank Williams song about a girlfriend of his who was getting married. It was called Wedding Bells, and it said, I've got the invitation that you sent me. You wanted me to see you change your name. I couldn't bear to see you wed another, but dear, I hope you're happy just the same. And that's poetic. It's speaking to something universal. It's speaking to some emotion within us that touches us, that we can all share. And that's what opened the world of words and music and poetry up to me. What did it for you?
I guess just sort of hearing poems and songs that as a child, and our mother had, you know, made up songs for us. And then I think what really sort of, when poetry first took me by the scruff of the neck, was when I was a teenager and studying Macbeth, and which is a great play for teenagers, I think, because it's got everything in it: sex, betrayal, revenge, murder, treachery, and your speeches like, you know, I come you, Lady Macbeth speech when Duncan's coming into the castle, and she's plotting to murder him. She says, come ye spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here and fill me from the crown to the toe, top full of direst cruelty, and so on. And I thought, wow, I remember the hairs going up on the back of my neck. And I found Shakespeare's language really thrilling, also difficult at times. You had to sort of sometimes pick your way through it, but when you did it, it was like it exploded.
Hmm. And did you hear the music in the words as well? Because I know you put Shakespeare to music. Was that part of the attraction to you, just even hearing you recite that? There is a musicality to the words, isn't there?
Yeah, well, there was, you know, as you know, his plays were written mostly in verse, in 10-syllable verse or pentameter. It was much, much later that I started putting poems to music. It was something that I never thought could be done. I'd always written songs, or, you know, where I start with I get a tune first and some kind of shape of a song, and then some sounds, and then I just get words to match the sounds. That's how I used to mainly write my songs, still do. But it was only about 8 years ago when I was involved doing a collaboration with a classical composer, James Ledger, for ANAM, the Australian National Academy of Music, and we've set some poems to music. And once we'd done that, I thought, I can keep doing that. And I started doing some Shakespeare poems and took off from there. But it's interesting because the sonnet is really, has lots of parallels with a pop song. You know, the sonnet has 14 lines, there are rules, there's the two verses, and then two, you know, the first 8 lines are like, can be like two verses. The next 4 lines are often called the turn or the volta, where there's supposed to be a switch of point of view or a change of emphasis, which is like a bridge in a pop song. And then the last 2 lines of a sonnet rhyme, they're a couplet, they rhyme with each other, and that's like a chorus. So I started putting some Shakespeare sonnets to music, and they had that natural sort of structure that a pop song has.
And of course, you know, you say you put poetry to music, but, you know, when I was thinking about doing this tonight with Paul, my mind went immediately to the poetry of his own lyrics and we all know these songs that are imprinted on our minds, you know. They got married early, never had much money. Then when he got laid off, really hit the skids, started up his drinking. Then he started fighting. She took it pretty badly. She took both the kids. What came to mind immediately for me, though, was that beautiful song of yours, Nakanya. Outside, the dogs are barking. The morning sun is breaking through the trees. My heart is feeling heavy as I listen to the moaning of the breeze. Nakanya, baby, I really don't want to leave. So this was in you. These songs work to be spoken as they do as much to be performed, don't they?
Do you want to do a spoken word record of that? I like that.
You wouldn't want me to sing them.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Nakanya, because the first line of that song is the first line of a Bob Dylan song, Outside the Dogs Are Barking. I can't remember the song. You probably would know it. Which one is it?
Outside the Dogs Are Barking. No.
It's an early song of Bob Dylan, so, which is... it's sort of part of what we're talking about tonight, how songs and words, they come from other places, they swim around. I mean, I came up in folk music where words and titles, lines, phrases jumped from song to song, and changed from song to song, and you could take them and use them. So I've always, had nicked lines from other poems, from other songwriters, from other songs, that they pop up in my songs all the time, and that's that's part of writing, is picking it up and passing it on.
Mm. We've got a whole stack of books here. When I thought about doing this tonight with Paul, I thought, what are the poets that speak to me, and why they speak to me? And I looked particularly, Paul, being an Indigenous person in the world, being Wiradjuri Gamaroi Dharawal person, having Irish heritage with all of the inheritance of that, of wanting to understand what history does to you, understand your place in the world, how you carry that, how you find freedom, how you find joy, how you find love in a world that can often be so brutal. And I just want to read a little bit of T.S. Eliot, again, that really speaks to something that I think I look for, and speaks, I think, to this age as well. After such knowledge, what forgiveness? Think now. History has many cunning passages, contrived corridors and issues, deceives with whispering ambitions, guides us by vanities. Think now. She gives when our attention is distracted, and what she gives with such supple confusions, that the giving famishes the craving, gives too late what's not believed in, or if still believed, in memory only reconsidered passion, gives too soon into weak hands what's thought can be dispensed with, till the refusal propagates a fear. And I think so much of that I've looked for in poetry is trying to explain or trying to understand the fear that's in us, and living with the weight of a history, and living with that sense of uncertainty in the world. What do you think speaks to the age that we're in now when you think of poetry? Who comes to mind? Who speaks to what you look around our world and what we're going through?
I keep coming back to... there's some Polish poets, Miłosz and Szymborska, and they wrote poems in wartime. There's something in the water in Poland. They have so many great poets, but even with simple poems, there's other stuff around the edges. I guess I like stories or poems where it's not all laid out before you, but you can feel, like you said, maybe it's history, it's horror often, it's bad things going on in the world, but they're still choosing to bear witness, love, live and sing. Miwash, you know, love means learning to look at yourself as one looks at a distant thing. Anyone who sees that way will, I'm probably not quoting it properly, anyone whoever sees that way will heal his heart without knowing it. A friend and a bird and a tree say to him, friend. So, some of my favourite poems of his are those really simple ones about celebrating life and the fragility of life despite all this tornado going
on. And you're right about the Polish poets, because they speak, this comes from a long dark winter, doesn't it? You know, and Czesław Miłosz, who was the Nobel Prize winning poet, who was Lithuanian but raised in Poland, exiled to France and the United States. And in his Nobel Prize winning speech, said that perhaps he was a Lithuanian for whom it was not meant to be a Lithuanian, that he could never truly find a home. And I've always been attracted to those writers of exile. You know, you think of James Joyce in Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, and he says, I go in search of the unconstructed conscience of my race, to look for that thing beyond certainty or beyond knowing. There's a beautiful line from a Miłosz poem where he reflects on war and the impact of war and what happens after you have lived through catastrophe. You got used to new wet winters, to a villa where the blood of the German owner was washed from the wall and he never returned. I too accepted but what was possible, cities and countries. One cannot step twice into the same lake on rotting alder leaves, breaking a narrow sun streak. Guilt, yours and mine, not a great guilt. Secrets, yours and mine, not great secrets. And that ability to wake up to a new day and wash the blood from the walls, but find something that allows you to go on. And Paul, I don't know about you, but I find in poetry, I find the essence of that. You know, yes, I love prose, I love short stories, I love novels, I love nonfiction. But there is something about the ability to capture the essence in a poem that you don't find in other forms of literature, do you?
Yeah, I think it's a way to make joy out of pain. I guess that's what telling stories is. There's a great story about Tom Hardy, one of my favourite poets, and who most of his poems are, I have to say, probably fall into the melancholy category. I mean, they're much more than that, but his poems are a lot about the evanescence of life and transience of life. And poetry was his great love more than his novel writing. But his wife wrote a letter to a friend, said, Tom's in very good spirits today. He's just written a very melancholy poem. You know, so Tom was there wrestling with his, you know, he was very conscious of meter and rhyme, and he was always innovating in his techniques. But he got happiness out of writing his sadness away. That's what he was doing.
Hank Williams.
Yeah.
You know, do you find that? Do you have to feel a certain way? Do you have to be motivated in a certain way to find that in yourself, to write a song? And can writing a sad song make you happy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm more from the Robert Burns school of songwriting of poetry. He says, I rhyme for fun. That's one of his poems. So I don't see songwriting as a sort of form of self-expression or therapy. For me, it's more like playing a game or solving a puzzle. But I do write a lot of sad songs, but I'm a fairly cheerful person, but I write a lot of sad songs. that's probably because it's much easier to write a sad song than a happy song. I mean, it's much easier to write about conflict or yearning or things gone wrong. It's very hard, much harder to write about things going right without being banal. So I guess a lot of singer-songwriters do write sad songs, but actually, I can remember writing some really quite sort of dark, sad songs and feeling very, very pleased with myself. You know, sort of,
and we're glad for it.
And getting back to Hank, I mean, the beauty of Hank, we'll probably keep coming back to Hank all night, I suspect. But his songs often sound very cheerful. You can whistle them; they're upbeat. Even the saddest song in the world, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, you hear the band playing it, and there's a real pep in their step.
Yeah, yeah.
And every other person who ever covers that song does it slower than Hank. But Hank knew, you know, it's a sad song, but here, keep it up, make it a cheery song. And Muddy Waters said, sing sad songs happy and sing happy songs sad. So I think it's really good advice for songwriters.
Mm. You know, when you think about songs as well, what is it, do you think, is that indefinable quality? And people will have a different experience depending on what sort of music you like or what your ear goes to. But if I think of a song like Waterloo Sunset, the Kinks.
Oh, greatest song of all time.
Perhaps it is. Perhaps it is. And, you know, you have that beautiful scene of a boy looking out a window and looking at a world passing by. Millions of people gather like flies around Waterloo Underground.
Like flies,
yeah, around that Waterloo Underground. You know, Terry and Julie cross over the river, yeah, where they feel safe, yeah, and sound. And it's that looking on to a world. What do you think it is in a song like that that seems to be so universal? And it's not a sad song. I don't find it, you know. It just evokes London, and I had the pleasure of watching him sing it at the Albert Hall, just him and a guitar, and, you know, Dirty Old River, just beautiful, setting, yeah, it all up. But what is it about that, do you think, that strikes such a chord and can do it immediately? You hear the opening of the song, you hear that first refrain, and you're gone.
I don't know. It's pretty mysterious why songs work. I know with Ray Davies, he's a very visual songwriter. So, yeah, like straight away you're there and you've got the picture. And he just, I mean, the melody is just so gorgeous. It's just, and like it's joyful and sad at the same time. Great you mentioned that song, because I'm often asked, what's your favourite song? And you said, Waterloo Sunset.
I was asked exactly the same thing, and it was exactly the same answer. I did one of these ABC night things where they talk about your favourite songs, and it was my favourite song. Yeah. There's just something about that that just captures something in me, and I don't know whether it's the same for you, but it's that reserve, it's that standing back and watching a world, not necessarily even participating in a world, but being there.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm drawn to those, I guess I'm drawn a lot to that, what I would call the cinematic or visual songwriters. I think Lou Reed's another one. You can see his songs, like, you know, Up to Lexington, 125, Feeling Drunk and Dirty, More Dead Than Alive. It's like, okay, you're right there. So they're songs, they're set in a particular place with particular people doing things, and you can smell those songs.
Well, you mentioned that, like Waiting for My Man, and you're there in New York, you get the feel of it. And he's obviously a quintessentially New York songwriter, in the way that Ray Davies may be a quintessentially English songwriter, yeah, and you may be a quintessentially Australian songwriter, and yet we can be in different parts of the world and we can feel something. You don't even have to go to be in New York or even to have been to New York to know what Lou Reed is, to feel what Lou Reed is telling,
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Memphis, Tennessee by
Chuck Berry.
Chuck Berry. Yeah. I never, you know, always, that song's not about Memphis, Tennessee. It's about a father missing his daughter. But, you know, so you don't have to go to the visuals are all there, the phone on the wall. And
It goes to something that I often wonder about, and you know, my reporting around the world, you know, I've lived outside of Australia for nearly 20 years, and I've reported from more than 80 countries, and many of them in the worst possible circumstances. And I see, yes, I see the incredible human spirit and love at the essence of that human spirit. And that is universal. And yet I also know that there are things that are very distinct. There are things that are just us. And I wonder about, we mentioned Rumi before, but I read a poem like Saladin's Begging Bowl that tries to capture the essence of some universality, that there is not just, we are not just alone in the world. Of these 2,000 I and we people, which am I? Don't try to keep me from asking. Listen when I'm this out of control, but don't put anything breakable in my way. There is an original inside me. What's here is a mirror for that, for you. If you are joyful, I am. If you grieve, or if you're bitter or graceful, I take on those qualities. Like the shadow of a cypress tree in the meadow, like the shadow of a rose, I live close to the rose. If I separated myself from you, I would turn entirely thorn. And I just, you know, it goes to that tension in the world that we see today, where it is so easy to retreat. It is so easy to not wash the blood from the walls. It is so easy to look at someone else and not be able to see yourself in someone else. And we know that that is the essence of so much of the horror that we've seen in our world. And then there are beautiful moments where Rumi can look at something like that and say that, yes, I am you and you are me. Where do you sit with that idea of what is universal and what is particular?
Yeah.
I think too much about these things.
To me, the particular is universal, you know. There's, in every country, humans in every country do much the same things, you know. Pick an apple from the tree, feed their children, try and find good work, try and be good parents, good friends, try to help people when they're dying and on the way out. I mean, most of our experiences we all have. So we're so much. Our similarities are so much greater than our differences, and I think at times we forget that. I think we tend to take this what's our common humanity for granted, and then we often get focused on the differences.
How do you approach that? And you've collaborated with a lot of Indigenous writers. You've performed with a lot of Indigenous writers, and you've tried, and I think you have managed to capture the essence of the humanity in what is a bigger story too, a bigger story of a fight for justice in songs like From Little Things, Big Things Grow, or, you know, Special Treatment. You know, these songs where you find that strength and that particular experience, but connect it to something bigger. What does it mean to you to be able to be involved in that process of trying to tell the story of this country and collaborating and writing with First Nations people in this country?
Oh, I think it's been it's been a great privilege for me to work with Indigenous artists, you know, for many years, and that sort of just came about from travelling around and being curious, and then starting to get involved and hearing, listening to people's stories, and then starting to dig more into our history. The very important book for me was Henry Reynolds, The Other Side of the Frontier, when I read that in the mid-80s. And that really opened my eyes up to the fact that there'd been lots of wars going on when Australia was taken over by Europeans, and we'd never learned any of that in history. I never learned about the resistance warriors. I never learned about Pemulwuy, and never learned about Jundamara. I never learned about Yagan in the west, or in my hometown in Melbourne, Tuminawait and Malbohina, the first people hanged in Melbourne in 1941, fought a resistance war in the Mornington Peninsula. I never learned about these are people we should be celebrating on Anzac Day. They died fighting for their country. And I think, you know, I think Anzac Day is a solemn, important day, and the meaning has expanded over the years to, you know, it's not just about Gallipoli anymore. It's about all the wars that Australians were involved in, that's why these people should be in this story too, fighting for their country. But yeah, so I'm going a roundabout way, but as a songwriter, you know, I hear stories, and I guess it doesn't come from, I want to tell this story, but a song like From Little Thing, Big Things Grow didn't start with, I'm going to write a song about that. It started with the image of Mervyn Bishop's photo of
Vincent Lingyari.
Gough Whitlam pouring dirt into Vincent Lingyari's hands. And it's an incredible image. And I'm just on a camping trip with Kev Carmody, and we started talking about it, talking about that photo and talking about the story. And then the song came out of that. So often it's, for me, it's a really striking image or something visual that kicks the song off, not like, I need to tell this story.
Mm.
I mean, I wrote a song about Charlie Perkins called A Bastard Like Me, but that was his words. That was the title of his autobiography. Yeah. So, and as a songwriter, you see a bastard like me, and you think, that's a great title for a song. And so they sort of, you know, I guess it's just like keeping your ears open. And I think writing is paying attention, pretty much. That's how I would sum up writing.
You co-wrote Treaty as well, and we live in a country where we still don't have one. Does music have the ability to change a country, to change politics? And if so, after those songs, what stops us in this country?
I think music does have the ability to change things, just like everything else. I think it's often very slow, a slow influence, or one step forward, two steps back influence, or they work in ways you don't quite know. But I think we're books, talking, laws. I mean, everything you do. I think everything we do is political, so it does have change. But I think the reason, perhaps, why we've been so slow to make a treaty, to make proper reparations, is that I think a lot of Australia's history has been hidden. And getting back to Henry Reynolds' book again, The Other Side of the Frontier, he makes a point in that book that the government, the first government of settlement, they were supposed to treat the natives peaceably and treat them fairly, and then they ended up with a war and reprisals, and the war escalated, but they could never admit there was a war going on. So there was it was kept out of the official record. I mean, you can find that in the official record, but it was buried in ways. So I think we still have what Stanner calls the great silence. We've never, there's a great reluctance to really face up to what happened in this country with the dispossession and the massacres. And I don't think it's something to be afraid of, to face it head on. It's I think you just have to admit what happened and tell the truth. But if we can't even admit that these things happen, we can't really move forward. So otherwise, people start saying. Going to read something?
Well, you know, again, when I was thinking of what I wanted to bring here, and Albert Camus has been such an important writer to me, and just listening to you then reminded me of something that he said in a short story, A Letters to a German Friend. There are means that cannot be excused, and I should like to be able to love my country and still love justice. I don't want any greatness for it, particularly a greatness born of blood and falsehood. I want to keep it alive by keeping justice alive. It's just, so, again, that someone in another country, in another language, can speak to someone like me here, looking onto my world and hearing what you say about our history, and just absolutely go to the essence of it. You know, Paul, I've wondered about myself, and I've probably come to a conclusion that probably doesn't reflect well on me, but it's true, that I probably love words, or like words, more than I like people. I certainly spend a lot more time with words than I do with people. My wife would tell you how hard it is to get me to leave the house or to put down a book. I just find that there is an honesty on the page when I read the writers who speak to me that I sometimes find it gets in the way of us as people, that the weight of our histories or the stories that we want to tell or the things we want to keep hidden stop us having a connection that I find on the page. Would you say the same thing about yourself, that you like words more than
words,
people?
Yeah, words last longer than people. Words don't let you down. But it's not one of those games, you know. Would you have, you know, people or words?
Or words, yeah.
People, I think I'd have to go with people in the end. But we're the talking animal, so I think people and words, you can have both.
And it's trying to capture that thing, isn't it? It's trying to capture that. Even when I sit alone with those words, I love sitting and observing people, or I love thinking.
And the words are written by people.
They're written by people. There was a story.
Unless it's the
Quran. I don't have to like the people who wrote the words either to like the words. Let me tell you, there are some pretty objectionable people that I like reading. We were talking before we came out here, and I was talking about, you know, poetry and stories, and there was a story I wanted to read, and you said that you would have a response in a song. Is that right, or just a response in another poem?
You're mentioning
Turgenev.
If you're going to read a Turgenev story, the one you're talking
about the pigeons.
Well, from what I gather, I don't know the story. There's probably a good answer in this book, but
okay.
Let's see. Let's hear it first.
I don't. Now, this is a story about written by Ivan Turgenev, and he's outside and he's looking at the sky as dusk is falling, and there's a thunderstorm on the horizon. All nature lay low, waiting, languishing under the sinister glitter of the waning sunlight. There was not a bird to be heard or seen. Even the sparrows had gone into hiding. The only sound was the insistent whispering and slapping of a large and solitary burdock leaf somewhere near me. The cloud made no move. It hung oppressively over the mute world and only swelled and loomed all the darker. And suddenly, something flickered across its solid dark blue, something like a small white handkerchief or a snowball. This turned out to be a white pigeon flying from the village. It flew straight on, smoothly and rhythmically, straight on until it vanished behind the forest. Several moments passed. The silence was still as grim. But look, there were now two little white handkerchiefs flitting across the cloud, two snowballs returning home. They were two white pigeons flying confidently home. Both were tousled, and each felt the nearness of the other with his wing. They were content. I too felt content watching them, although I am alone, alone as I always am. I love that story.
Yeah, that's a good
I love that story. But again, it's an ability to even be alone, but to see beauty in the world and to look at darkness and see out of a darkness that there is some light, there is something in a bird and a bird that goes and fetches his or her mate and how they nestle together and find contentment.
Yeah.
And even when you're alone, you can find that.
Yeah.
What was the one that you had to...
Well, you may as well answer a Russian with a Russian. Anna Akhmatova. Death's great wing scrapes the air. No, sorry, first line. Everything is plundered, betrayed, sold. Death's great black wing scrapes the air. Misery gnaws to the bone. Why then do we not despair? By day, from the surrounding woods, cherries blow summer into town. At night, the deep transparent skies glitter with new galaxies. And the miraculous, I'll just get this line here. And the miraculous comes so close to the ruined dirty houses, something not known to anyone at all, but wild in our hearts for centuries.
Wow. Before we go to it, yes, you can applaud, yes. I'd love to take some questions. If someone wants to want to make their way to the front, Paul will sing another song. And we'll have some time to take a few questions. But before we do that, Paul, would you just mind reading a little bit of that Rumi poem that you were reading to me out the back?
It's called A Thirsty Fish. I don't get tired of you. Don't grow weary of being compassionate toward me. All this thirst equipment must surely be tired of me. The water jar, the water carrier. I have a thirsty fish in me that can never find enough of what it's thirsty for. Show me the way to the ocean. Break these half measures, these small containers, all this fantasy and grief. Let my house be drowned in the wave that rose last night in the courtyard, hidden in the center of my chest. Joseph fell like the moon into my well. The harvest I expected was washed away, but no matter. A fire has risen above my tombstone hat. I don't want learning or dignity or respectability. I want this music and this dawn and the warmth of your cheek against mine. The grief armies assemble, but I'm not going with them. This is how it always is when I finish a poem. A great silence comes over me, and I wonder why I ever thought to use language.
Well, we certainly are glad you do use language, Paul, and you have a song for us. Would you sing another one? And then we'll have some questions from the audience.
I'll sing a song called The Magpies, just because it does, it's got a bit of Hank about it. And it's a song that, yeah, it's written by a New Zealand poet, Dennis Glover, and you see it on the page, and it's just like a song lyric. So it was written pretty quickly, and on one level, it seems like light verse. He's He writes down what he thinks the sound of the magpie is. Quaddle doodle, addle, waddle doodle are the words on the page. And that's. But to me, it's a really deadly serious song. It's got lots and lots of stuff in it. The magpies.
When Tom and Elizabeth took the farm, the bracken made their bed. And quaddle-loodle, addle, waddle-loodle, the magpie said. Tom's hand was strong to the plow, Elizabeth's lips were red. And quaddle-loodle, addle, waddle-loodle, the magpie said. Year in, year out they were, while the pines grew overhead. And quaddle-loodle, addle, waddle-loodle, the magpie said. But all the beautiful crops soon went to the mortgage man instead. And quaddle-loodle, addle, waddle-loodle, the magpie said. Elizabeth is dead now, that's long ago. Old Tom went lying in the hay. And quaddle-loodle, addle, waddle-loodle, the magpie said. The farm's still there, mortgage corporations couldn't give it away. And quaddle-loodle,
the magpie say. Can I just say something? That was just beyond eerie for me. Paul and I never talked about that final song. My dad hasn't been very well lately, and he's having a hard time, and his totem is the magpie, and when he wasn't well, he had a dream one night that he saw the Garu, which is the magpie, on the front lawn, and they were speaking to him in Wiradjuri language, and it was his dad and his grandfather, and they were telling him that it wasn't his time to go yet. And I can't believe you sang that song, Paul.
Did you got a near near thanks, Unc, for your beautiful language before, and for that story of the Bujan there. Yeah. Paul, I'm such a huge fan, as I'm sure everybody here is, and I'm a writer, a poet, and I'm super interested in taking poetry and turning it into music. I'm really curious to know about what that process looks like for you and how it starts, and yeah, just the whole process. How do I go from poem to song?
When I write my own songs with my own words, it's often quite slow, and the music part is often quite quick, and the words are very slow. The beauty for me of putting poems to music, other people's words, is that obviously I'm not doing that unless it's a poem I love. So for me, I'm over halfway part of, you know, that's, words are the hardest part of writing songs for me. So to have a beautiful set of words to start with, it's like I'm almost there. And so, but the rest of it's accidental. So I might love a poem, and I'll quickly have a go at trying to put music to it. And if it doesn't work, I move on pretty quickly. And then if it does work, it usually happens pretty quickly. Like that one, the magpies one was like, you know, just sort of fell out straight away. So I guess the answer is I don't think about it that much. It feels very accidental every time I do it. But I feel very lucky that I've had this great set of words to start with. That's the gist of it.
It's that easy, huh? Thank
you. Just add 40 years and stir.
have a question. I've seen a lot of poetry being more dry and looks like prose. Do you think that to make songwriting with poetry, it is essential that the poetry should be more musical? I have one more addition. Do you think that words have life, but it blossoms only with music?
I'm not sure if I... Were there two questions in there? Yeah. So the first one, you think that the words should be melodic, need to be melodic too?
If you want to make songs, the words should be melodic?
Yes, I think so. And I think, you know, a good poem is melodic. Even poems that you might, you know, some people, even poems that are like, don't rhyme or free verse. A good poem has its own melody and rhythm. So, I put rhyming poems to music, but I also have, it's sometimes it's a bit slower with free verse poems, but there's sometimes you can find a melody there, and again, it's sort of mysterious. So I don't think it has to be obviously melodic, but I think every good poem has that.
Yeah, a reason why I asked is that my son is listening always to rap. That's why I asked
him. Oh, that's good.
Oh, yeah.
That's well, good.
That's, yeah. Well, that's poetry. There's so much. It's supple, great, supple, right, supple. You know, I love hip hop and rap because of the way they mess with rhymes, internal rhymes, all kinds of rhymes, across the beat rhymes. And that's like, yeah, that's where a lot of the great modern poetry is. Welcome everybody to the Wild Wild West, the state of untouchable like Elliot Ness, and, you know. And so, yeah, I love it. That's a lot of poetry out there. Thank you.
Well, but you know, you mentioned Chuck Berry before. Chuck Berry was really the progenitor of rap, right? As I was motivating over the hill, I saw Maybelline in a Coupe de Ville, Cadillac doing about 95, bumper to bumper, we're side by side.
Yeah.
Maybelline. Hey. Well, I can't meet you.
Hi. I'm sure that most of us have been drawn here tonight because we admire how you convey the universality of experience, both of you, and have done so in our country for so long, which is not to say you're old. And everyone you've quoted has spoken about those ordinary experiences. Stan, I love the fact that you opened talking about your grandmother or your great-grandmother.
My great-grandfather, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, well, there was a woman in there. Guruin.
Yeah, my great-great-grandmother, yeah.
Your great-great-grandmother. What occurred to me when I was sitting here, and I couldn't unhear it, and I have heard you both speak at Sydney Writers' Festival before and admired what you said, is that none of the examples included women. And to me that's quite strange because I admire you so much. And as I say, when I just heard it with a different set of ears tonight. And I wondered whether either or both of you, and Paul, you know, obviously the stories, the domestic ordinariness of the stories that you tell, have allowed women to have a voice but still in the background. And I wonder if either of you have thought about addressing that as something cultural in our country that needs to be understood.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's, you know, before we came out here, I was talking to Paul about growing up and that the stories that I was raised on were the stories of my mother and the poetry my mother writes, and the way that she was able to distill our struggle into just simple words that touched on such a deep love. And that's what I've got. I mean, you're right. I mean, the examples, you know, I've spoken here about tonight because I was talking about a certain theme that I wanted to address. But there are many, many women that, you know, growing up in my own community, who told the stories of who we are. And, you know, if I think about writers that I love, one of the, you know, obvious ones for me was someone like Toni Morrison, who especially spoke to that thing in me that to try to write beyond someone else's gaze. She once said that as a writer, she sought to write free in a wholly racialized, genderized, and sexualized world. And I can't begin to sort of understand or speak for the experience that she speaks at as a black woman in that, but the universality of that speaks to freedom in me. So you're right, I think that's absolutely central for me, and something that I was completely raised in, because our culture was women, and the women were the great storytellers, and gave us a great survival and love. But Paul, I mean, Paul, you, when you come to write from another voice and being aware of writing from another voice, how do you approach that, especially if that voice is a woman?
Well, a lot of my songs come from the things people say. So, a lot of the songs I've written from the point of view of women have just come from things that I've been told or things that I've heard. So, a way into a song often is to be imagine a character in a particular situation. So, and they can be the. Again, going back to folk music, men sing songs from the point of view of women and vice versa, or, you know, 20th century people sing songs about 19th century captains, and people sing as ghosts from beyond the grave. So there's this great fluidity in folk music where the voice moves around, and that's sort of always influenced me. We did have Anna Akhmatova tonight, but I guess your point is well made. I think we were quoting men most of the night, except for Anna. So fair play.
And two men on the stage. It's really interesting too. If you look, might have more time for one more. Which, if I think about a song like "To Her Door," Paul, is that obviously it's to her door, and obviously there is a woman here who is making a decision in her life that she is not going to put up with this anymore. And yet the point of view is the man trying to make amends for that. So when you come to write that, would that be the point of view that you would go to, that you would write from the point of view as of the man, even if the song is about the experience of the woman? Or would you, or how, are there times when you inhabit that other voice entirely?
Yeah, there are times when I inhabit other voices entirely, and I've written a lot of songs for women to sing. So I'm often writing with that in mind. It's not really that conscious. And you know, as the last questioner picked up, we unconsciously quoted men tonight. So we've always got to probably be. Keep an eye on ourselves, I think, because that was one of the things putting this book together. You know, I put together a collection of my favourite poems, and I know there's going to be an unconscious bias there. So I really worked hard at apart from, you know, the putting in the poems that I knew I love straight away. I had the luxury of, you know, reading poetry for a year and discovering new poets, and I think it's important to keep looking for new voices and all points of view.
Final question, thank you.
First, let me begin by saying that this has been a great thing to come to, not just for you, Mr. Kelly, but also for you, Mr. Grant, whose urology for Gough Whitlam I actually studied in high school. Like, has anybody else done that? Just okay, it appears, yeah. It also appears I'm too tall for the microphone. yeah, Yeah. So can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Mr. Kelly, you have spoken a lot on the subject of songs and poems and interpreting poems as songs. I think a lot of people here would consider From Little Things, Big Things Grow to be, in some sense, one of the great Australian poems. How does that make you feel as a songwriter or, yeah?
The song I wrote it with Kev Carmody, and the most, I guess the thing we like most about that song is that it has become like a folk song, and it keeps changing and mutating all the way. There have been lots and lots of versions of that song with different words. So it does what a folk song does. It's something. It's like a tool that someone else can pick up and use. And there's a new version of that song coming very soon by a young hip-hop artist. I think he's here tonight, Ziggy Ramo, so watch out for that. He has completely retooled the song, so he drilled out the middle of it and then refashioned it. And I'm just on around the edges. And it's pretty cool. Anyway, so stay tuned.
That's all we have time for. There's a lovely phrase. It was written by a Scottish politician, and I think it hangs over the Scottish Parliament. It says that if I could write all the songs, I would not care who wrote the laws. Thank you for writing the songs, Paul. Thank you all. Thank you all for coming along. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.